Welcome to the Dash Arts podcast, seeing the world through an artistic lens. I'm Josephine Burton, Artistic Director of Dash Arts.
And hello, I'm Marie Horner, the podcast producer for Dash Arts. And in this month's episode, we're meeting author, TV producer and journalist Peter Pomerantsev, who was the spark for Dash Arts making our new theatre production, The Reckoning.
So Peter, as well as being a friend of Dash Arts, I think we launched his book, Nothing is True and Everything is Possible. I hope that's the name of the title. I always get it confused. But we launched it back at a Dash Cafe in, I think, about 10 years ago. And he's definitely participated in subsequent events and conversations since the full-scale Russian invasion of Ukraine began 2 years ago. Peter set up with Janine DeGiovanni the Reckoning Project, which is gathering testimonies from survivors of detentions, of torture and shelling. And he's brought together journalists and lawyers and analysts to collect the stories so they can be submitted as evidence in international courts of law.
Peter came to you in November 2022, so over a year ago now, and asked you, is there a play in these people's stories? And you said, yes, there is. Why did you say yes?
I often just say yes without really thinking about things. And then I kind of open the Pandora's box and kind of take a big inhalation. But I think I was already working at that point on Crimea 5am, which is the show we made at the beginning of 2022 last year. No, 2023. I've lost all track of time. And I was working at the time with Anastasia Kosody, kind of connected over her extraordinary play that she wrote with Natalia Wolerschmidt, staging the stories of the kind of interviews with the families of Crimean Tatars who had been imprisoned in Crimea. And so I was already thinking about how do you bring these stories to the stage and tell these extraordinary, important stories in startling and important ways. And so I think I was talking to Peter about that project at the time. And then Peter said, oh, but actually, I've got this other project. So there was already, we'd sort of set up the conversation in a way that we, like, Dash does documentary theatre. Dash has been working in Ukraine for umpteen years, thinking about what, you know, thinking about Ukrainian, emerging Ukrainian identity. When I say emerging Ukrainian identity, I mean like a Ukrainian identity which continues to transform and evolve over the last 30 years since its independence. So he suggested it to me because he knew I was interested and I was already making documentary work. And I said yes, because it was Peter and I trust him. I'm a fan of his writing and we get on well. And I therefore think anything that Peter probably does is definitely worth considering. And I think I've also been trying to find a way of engaging as an artist with this horrific war that's been happening. Well, it's been going on since 2014, but particularly going on since February 22, and thinking, how can I tell and how can I be involved? How can I do something? And how can I feel useful? So I think it was the combination of all of those things which made me say yes. So Peter spends time between the US at Johns Hopkins University and the UK, where, you know, he's in and out of the UK all the time, and in Ukraine. And so it's actually really difficult to pin him down. And he's here this week because he's doing promo for his new book, How to Win an Information War. I just thought this would be an amazing opportunity while he's here in the UK to kind of spend a little bit of time with him, catching up on his motivations for the Reckoning Project and the bigger context for it, because we've already got quite stuck in the first episode of our series with the actual what the show is that we're making and how we're making it in the rehearsal room. I thought it'd be really important to sort of pull out and understand why the Reckoning Project exists and what its purpose is. There are so many ways I could introduce you, aside from being a friend. And I thought I might throw the mantle over to you and ask you to introduce yourself.
Sure. My name is Peter Pomerantsev. I am a senior fellow at Johns Hopkins University, where I focus on essentially on contemporary propaganda and how to fight it. Huge focus on Russia and the sort of disinformation that Russia spreads. And I'm also one of the founders of The Reckoning Project, which is a project dedicated to documenting and telling stories about war crimes in Ukraine. But part of the motivation for creating it was to make sure that the truth of what is happening in Ukraine is not submerged under a blizzard of lies. The crux of the idea is to bring together two professions that usually don't trust each other, but can actually work together to great effect, and that is journalism and law. So there's actually always been a lot of tension between journalists and lawyers in the war crimes field. Lawyers think that journalists turn up at crime scenes and essentially tamper with them. And there's some truth to that. The way journalists interview can re-traumatize people. We can ask leading questions, which makes it impossible to ever take that witness seriously again. We can essentially, and we can often be exploitative. That's part of journalism, sadly. On the other hand, journalists don't trust lawyers. Famously, some journalists sort of refuse to hand over their evidence to lawyers after the Yugoslav War, actually, quite famously. And often, even when journalists do want to help lawyers, when they turn up to The Hague and stuff to sort of give documentation, give evidence about war crimes, their notes are all over the place. The event has happened 4 years later. The witnesses have died or disappeared. The notes weren't accurate enough or in a way that was consistent enough for war crimes. So even when they do want to help the legal process, when they testify at The Hague, and Janine has testified there several times, the way they've collected evidence is useless. So even when they do want to work together, it fails. So we wanted to create an environment where journalists and lawyers would be helping each other, would be working together for our common aim of truth and justice. So that's the essence of what it is. So practically, it means training journalists so that when they do when they go to a crime scene, they collect evidence in ways that are consistent with international human rights law. So we have around 30 journalists now that are working with us, that have all been trained, gone through a very rigorous training of how to collect evidence in a way that doesn't ask leading questions, that doesn't re-traumatize people, that does no harm. The way they collect evidence is sort of verified constantly by a team of archivists and lawyers. A lot of questions about ethics, who you can and can't interview, especially when it comes to child abductions. And that's connected into an archive, which is then used in two ways. It's used for media and culture work on the one hand. So we tell stories based on the archive. And then at the same time, we have the legal team who are doing submissions to the UN and other relevant bodies and are starting now to build cases based on the archive.
Take us back to February 2020, so 2 years ago, when the war began, and where were you and what were you working on when it all started?
I was in Washington, D.C. A lot of my sort of university research is about Ukraine anyway. I've been very active there since 2014, working with local journalists. And when the invasion happened, I was talking both to the journalists inside Ukraine and to Janine DiGiovanni, who's a very, very famous war crimes reporter and human rights reporter. She was in New York. And the reckoning was born out of those conversations as we kind of began to understand, really in the days following the invasion, how brutal it would be and how we need to start documenting and telling stories about what was happening right now, rather than waiting until after the war or something. So it was born out of these kind of conversations, quite frantic ones that were happening during the invasion.
That initial kind of impetus to start it was 2 years ago. Has things changed for you and for the Reckoning Project since then?
I think we're beginning to understand the patterns of what is going on. But to be clear, war crimes documentation and bringing stuff to court, which we're also very involved with, is not something that takes months. It's something that takes many, many, many years. So we're always aware that there were both short-term aims around documentation and reporting, and there were long-term aims around case building and memory.
I think when Peter initially gave me access to the archive, our first place to go to was to read these extraordinary witness stories. And the more stories that I read, and the more I realised how important the journalists were in creating an environment where the witnesses feel comfortable sharing. And then I started to sort of, I suppose, the network expanded slowly. So I then met the team, the Reckoning Project team, not just Peter, but the wonderful team in Ukraine. I also had the privilege of meeting the lawyers and the archivists. And I had a wonderful time meeting one of your analysts in Berlin, who himself is Syrian, which was also completely fascinating to me that the team that you have who are from Syria are bringing their own experience of their own history of fighting or kind of fighting for justice from Russian perpetrators. So that to me was kind of, again, like a kind of mind expanding moment of kind of understanding this bigger context for the work the Reckoning Project's doing. And I asked this analyst, you know, like, it's extraordinary that they're able to, I hear this stuff. And he said, yeah, that's why, the analyst said, that's why we work with the journalists, because they can create that empathetic connection that we lawyers couldn't do, because I can't handle these stories. He said, memories, like the words make memories in my mind. I want to deal with the algorithms and the data. I'll leave the conversation to the journalists. Actually, it's just too much. I didn't know at the beginning that that would be the focus of our piece, that relationship between journalist and witness.
What do you feel like the journalists glean then from the lawyers? Because that's really articulate, that looking at the empathetic storytelling, but thinking about that relationship being functional, right? It's not just one way. So what do the journalists gain from the lawyers?
I think, yes, journalists are empathetic, but that doesn't mean that we don't do a lot of things that could potentially damage both the crime scene and the witness. So one of the big things that we get trained in, and some lesson for me as much as for anybody else, is how not to re-traumatize people, how not to ask leading questions. The re-traumatizing thing means taking things incredibly slowly. You come once, you come again, you never force people into a sort of a stressful emotional situation, which essentially is the point of a lot of journalism, to be frank. I used to work a lot in documentaries, and let's be perfectly frank, like, our aim was to get the people to cry on camera. That was, you know, that's what you needed to do. You needed to get them to cry on camera. That was like almost your mission. I mean, we would never do that in this sort of project. We go very, very slowly, and only taking sensitive information when people are ready for it. And something, we're doing a project about children right now, children's abductions. We don't interview the kids. If we do, it's the last resort. It's with law enforcement people present so that they don't have to do it a million times. And with very, very supervised. So, and it will be the last step of what we do, you know, if it's a completely and utterly necessary. So that's the absolute opposite of what you do as a journalist. You rush in and go, oh, look, it's a cute kid. Film him now. Film him. So, I mean, it really makes you stop and think both of the sort of the information integrity, but also of the sort of ethical boundaries.
The witnesses have been given permissions and for everything that they've given. So they've just been really eager to sort of share their stories.
Totally. Yeah. And it's an ethical thing, but it's a legal thing as well. You cannot take a traumatized witness to court.
So back in July 2023, when Anna-Cecilia and I first started reading the testimonies, we spent quite a lot of time chatting to your colleagues back in Kyiv, to lead journalist of the Reckoning Project, Natalia Gumenyuk, and I'm not sure of his exact title, but he's the archivist of the testimonies, Kostya Korobov, who knows them all really extremely well and was able to sort of point us in amazing directions as we were doing our research. And actually both of them reflected to me at the time really similarly about how they feel about their own motivations for the project.
For me, and what I see from our team, our motivation is, first of all, to find the sense of agency for ourselves, because when the war is going around and all the horrible things happen, you try to find the best job that you can do to help your country and help the people. And this is the way that you can contribute most. That's like kind of personal interest. Of course, we want justice and everything, like these high aspiration and beautiful words. But we just do what we can. That's it. Just not to go crazy.
Mm-hmm. I think it's really foremost what Kostya said. A lot of people were driven by justice, saying that the journalism doesn't work. know that the journalism doesn't work, but if it will get to the prosecutors, maybe then. At the same time, it's interesting that the lawyers usually would say that, you know, unless the story is covered, then it's, you know, not open, there is no case, there is no will at all, there is no, unless there is a public support, there is no will for the for prosecutors to really deal with that. I'm in this position that beyond, you know, bringing the justice to the victims, for me, the historical evidence is really important. You know, saying that, so for me, you know, knowing that thanks to our testimony, there would be a memorial, you know, in Bucha and Kramatorsk, and the person would be won't be forgotten, you know, means a lot. Because I don't take the bars that much. I really believe that so many victims are in the end just forgotten, and their story is not told. So I really want it for the history more than for anything else. Now, of course, I believe if we really, there is not really the direct prosecution, but I really believe that if there are the cases, we can opened and there are the processes, not exactly ours, but in general. We can change this narrative by Russia that there is no international law, there won't be justice, and they can do whatever they do. And it's not really direct. You know, for me, it's not important that there is a guy whom we recorded. It would be very good. But in general, to say there is a trial against, you know, a general who is shelling on the Ukrainian territory, to show that no, he won't be excused like it was with Syria. I think that's for us very, very important. And to prove that we can, you know, do something, that there is sense of our work. That, you know, like that there is a follow-up, that you really have this long relations with people and their story matters for somebody else.
Yeah, and the personal feeling, I think it changed, because when you first start doing, you know, what we do, it was just like, okay, we will try to do what we can. But now with the situation unfolds, we have contributed to one organization, to other, we see what we've done, and we like feel ourselves more strong, and we believe that we can reach our goals. Not maybe, I don't know which goals exactly, but that our work is worth something. It's not just for us. It really makes the world better.
But I also think it's not even like less linear. Now, for instance, I think there was more optimism with the courts and prosecutors. After we gather everything and have interaction with the prosecutors, actually knowing more what's going on, you really understand that most of the things won't be investigated. And if there would be the court case, there would be just a couple of them out of everything we recorded, to be honest. And maybe, you know, that if they even, it won't be direct, that we file the story for them and they definitely would investigate it. But you need to be already okay with the fact that maybe it would be a piece of the puzzle and it would be helpful. So I think we needed to really not have this very idealistic idea that you'd talk to the person and then there would be case. It won't be. I think I'm kind of less believing in that at this moment. But even if some of them already, but for me, if it would be also in the, you know, place like that, like the Dash Theater play, I think for me it would be also like a super ultimate, you know, thing, because this story would be told to somebody in a way which it won't be told by journalists, you know, that it definitely would have stronger emotional bound to a distant person somewhere else.
I'm interested to hear from you both about the impact of sitting in these stories has had on you personally. Josephine, maybe we could hear from you.
Yeah, I mean, I, you know, here we are as theatre makers, removed from these witnesses' stories. I mean, even if we are, you know, finding ways to retell their stories or share their stories on the stage, potentially, you know, 4,000 miles away, however far away we are from Ukraine, you know, I'm really mindful of the fact that the question of, are we re-traumatizing them in the process through doing that? And we actually brought in a therapist, a well-being practitioner and a therapist, Lou Platt, into our process to sort of help us ourselves handle the kind of look after ourselves in the context of dealing with this material. She was amazing. she gave us some great advice about basically kind of acknowledge that a part of us was hurting, but not the whole of us. So that was really useful, just looking after ourselves. I think it's just been a privilege for me to be spending time with this, really, this material. I don't feel, I sort of value my own. I don't have much else to say.
I've never heard you use language quite so vague and fluffy.
I'm also...
I'm worried.
It might simply be because I've not had enough caffeine yet this morning. I think it has been... I think you're right. It does sound a bit fluffy.
No, I don't mean that in a bad way. It sounds like, as if it's...
Actually, it's been an amazing journey. Okay. Yeah. But
you're on it now. So that might be really difficult to articulate.
Yes. Well, I'm sort of clear now what the piece is. I mean, there were times early on in the journey when I did read these stories, there were some extraordinary, awful tales of what people had been through. And there were moments when you have to just walk away. Like, you know, there were some lengthy witness statements that some of them, you know, extend to sort of 80 pages, where I did have to go, I can't read this anymore. I just have to just step away, go and spend some time walking, go and spend some time with the kids and come back. So there were those very dark moments. But actually, I think the thing that I found was there were moments of humour. Like, they were just brilliantly funny. There were some of these individuals who the Reckoning Project met are just extraordinarily funny. Like, they've still kept their humour despite it all. Yes, sometimes very bleak and dark, but also full of fun. There's a lovely story that I keep trying to bring up and I haven't quite managed to, and it's come out of the script at the moment, but I'd love to try and get it in again, where a lot of people keep talking about how the Russians kept stealing electric kettles. I don't know if you've come across this, Peter. It's very funny.
I didn't
notice
it as a pattern, no.
It comes up so much. Like, there's talk about the electric kettles being stolen because, you know, they've never seen electric kettles before. They're used to putting kettles on stoves. So, like, you know, four or five witnesses say, you know, they took the electric kettles, and then they say, but quite a lot of them said, but they didn't know that electric kettles need the base and the plug, so they left the plug and the base and they take these electric kettles without any way to use them, which they thought was so funny. And some of them kind of phrased it with such humor. And there was one particular witness who we've actually removed from the play, but that was the line that we had in. So I've lost her, and I've lost that joke. But finding a way to bring it back in is great. Because
you've got to put it back in.
It's this great anecdote.
Yes. I think you. I think you guys are actually... Because I'm a bit like Rat. I'm a bit like the analyst that you talk about in Berlin. I read the summaries, simply because there's so much, just to understand the patterns and which way we should push the story. So there's some stories I've gone very deep into, because I've helped put together the journalistic materials about them. But that was very focused on something like Yakhidne, which was a horrific incident in the history of the war, where a whole village was locked underground for almost a month in a cellar. So there I went very deep, because we were doing that story. But usually because I'm just looking at the summaries. I'm looking for patterns. Well, the summaries are quite dry. Mm. So I think you've spent as much time with it as... You know, there's two or three other people in the project who actually read the testimonies. There's the Ukrainian archivist, Konstantin. There's Natalia Guminyuk. So I think you've gone as deep as anyone, actually. So kudos to you. And well done. You probably actually know them better than me. No, really. No, I'm not doing it because of self-protection. I'm just doing it because of, like, time. But I haven't had the luxury to sort of treat this as literary material.
Given us that opportunities.
And Peter, what was the motivation to giving these testimonies to Dash?
So straight away when I looked at the material, because I always was reading the testimonies a lot at the start, I was like, oh, this is amazing documentary theatre material. I've never written a documentary play, but I've been sort of fascinated by the genre for many, many years. And the minute actually all of us looked at it in the team, we were like, oh, this is going to be fantastic documentary theatre. I mean, it's exactly what you want. It's raw testimony that you can shape into an arc. And it should be documentary theatre. You don't need to do sort of make stuff up. And it was obvious it was too much for journalism. Journalism would be able to cope with it. I also want to share the archive with great nonfiction writers as well, maybe even with fiction writers, but definitely nonfiction writers. You know, the material is so rich, and as Josephine says, so deep. It goes way beyond anything journalism, even a 3,000-word essay, could ever handle. So it's crying out to be articulated. and documentary theatre makes complete sense. And you know, Josephine and Dash have experience with that. There's not many people who do good documentary theatre. It was either Josephine or David Hare, and then I went for Josephine.
I wonder how many other people have thought that.
We put that on the strap line
many,
on the website.
Many.
It took me a little bit of time to realise that, to in that brilliant, in our way that Dash does in the process, that we just read a lot. So I think it took me a while of just going in deep and just thinking, how on earth can we make something from this?
There's maybe many that can be made. I'm not like, you know, this archive is a treasure chest of stories, and it's completely unique. And partly it's unique because of the rigor that the lawyers force the journalists to go through.
Yeah.
They go to a level of detail and a level of depth that you would, even the most featurey long form journalists would never do. And it's been a challenge for the journalists, even the ones who are used to doing long form journalism. Mm. Okay, we've got to get this much detail. You just don't do it. And as you get that detail, I think it brings out these relationships.
The relationships between things like the journalists and the witness.
It's a much more deeper process.
And actually, I mean, the story that I was actually going to also say was we ended up deciding to focus on one of the many, many, like over 300 witnesses statements that the Reckoning Project have. You know, we work with actors to tell that story. I realised that actually it needed the journalist there. The journalist needed to be there because it was the journalist. We were all the journalists in that moment, I suppose. But actually it would be the journalist that would help us to understand and help to draw the story out. And I needed to be in the room, to be in the rehearsal room to really understand that, how important that dynamic was.
I'm really interested in your point earlier, Peter, thinking about Dash's work in the context of war crime documentation happening often after the event, and that this is happening alongside live as it's unfolding and across the 2 years that this war has been happening. I'm really interested in the impact that has not only on the Reckoning Project and in terms of it having an end, in terms of what that looks like, but also how that influences our production at Dash. So Peter, I wonder if you could just talk a little bit more about the fact that this is happening alongside more atrocities happening, more testimonies that need to be gathered.
Well, listen, I mean, this is much bigger than the Reckoning. So the fact that the International Criminal Court sort of really, I think, when was it? In the first year of the war, opened a case against Vladimir Putin is amazing. I mean, you think about other cases, Slobodan Milosevic, it happened, I can't remember, a decade after the war. So the fact that it's starting now, the cases are being built already, is remarkable. And I know it feels that the wheels of justice barely turn, but actually, well, compared to other events in the history of international law, they're spinning much faster than they usually do. Mm-hmm. So that's sort of, you know, thrilling and exciting. And I suppose it makes the legal process almost part of the war, because, you know, these things have political consequences. And if Putin can't travel to a lot of places now because of a court case against him or a charge against him around the illegal deportation of children, then, or the abduction of children, essentially, that's a big deal in the middle of a war. So I suppose it makes justice part of the, not a sort of like, I don't know, a post-bellum thing, but a sort of like, in the midst of things, and I suppose it gets caught up in the dynamics of it. In terms of that single case where you go, this person did this to me, and you lock them up, that's going to be relatively rare and very slow. Mm. That's always going to be slow. I mean, and it's never going to give the sense of retribution, I think you said, that people hope for. But no, it is being used for a lot more, just to be clear. I mean, the archive is used for a lot of other things apart from just building that one individual case. So the testimonies are used, and the size of it does matter, because then you can establish a pattern. You can say, look, you know, the abduction of children is not one or two cases. This is systemic.
Yeah.
The, you know, indiscriminate bombardment is systemic, and here's the evidence. So it is important to have bulk as well to make a lot of cases. So every testimony does matter.
I'm wondering if there's anything you wanted to share with Peter about the play and where we're at with that process.
Yeah, tell me more, because aren't we rewriting the script?
So we had this kind of amazing week in December, mm-hmm. where we immersed ourselves in the material, learnt a lot. Some things work beautifully, like particularly lifting the, you know, kind of working a physical theatre to lift the storytelling off the page. I loved hearing bits of Ukrainian, like, you know, some of the witnesses are speaking in their original language. It's very exciting. Working with these Ukrainian actors who have relocated themselves since the war brings an extra, like, a layer of understanding to the audience, but also to all of us from what they bring. So finding ways to work all of that in. So I returned to Berlin, spent a couple of days with Anastasia, re-looking at the script since that, taking quite a lot out. Lots of cuts, including we've actually reduced the cast from 6 to 4, which I think will strengthen the show. Focused a lot more on, as I just said, that relationship between the journalist and the witness, feeling like it's so important how they both learn from each other and are impacted by their encounter with each other. So we've done some work. It's really exciting. And we're now working on the design. So I got sent some early kind of rough sense of what the designs for the staging could look like at the weekend.
Amazing. Wow, I didn't know we were that far on.
Wow. So we're designing it. I'm thinking about how we're going to project and map translations of the text, like when we have the Ukrainian, like how actually we can make it the most exciting bit of the show rather than come on, get over the Ukrainian so I can go back to the English. I really want the Ukrainian to feel really at the heart of the piece. So we're thinking, I'm working with a brilliant projection mapping video designer to think about that. And I'm going to Vienna next week to work with Anton Bybakov, who is our Ukrainian sound composer. Mm,
of course,
so yeah. He and I are working on this kind of the sound world for the show, and we're going to work on that next week. And then we are just working out where it's going to play. I mean, we've got fundraising to do. We still need to raise quite a lot of money before it moves into production. But that is the purpose of the year, fundraising and working, you know, putting the show on indefinitely in London, hopefully elsewhere, probably early next year. It takes a while to find the right theatre and the right partner. But that's really, we're moving ahead.
That's fantastic. I didn't realise we were onto sort of design and projection. That's really heartening to hear.
Where would you like to see the play be shown?
Well, obviously very interesting to see it in Ukraine. I'd love for it to go to places that aren't that attached to the war, but might have their own histories of war and trauma, and see if they could relate to it. Because there are a lot of places that for whom this is a European war, and, you know, I'm thinking places in Latin America, maybe Africa, where this, you know, this is a war somewhere, you know, somewhere far away. And so news doesn't really cut through, but maybe something experiential like this, that puts the human experience first, might connect. Because it's been very interesting talking to people from Africa that, you know, for example, who experienced Boko Haram's kidnapping of children, how they relate to the stories of Ukrainian children being abducted by Russia. So there's all these connections that can occur when you take it out of the immediate political context. So that would be very interesting to see how does this relate to people in, you know, who've gone through similar stories of brutal occupation in wherever, really, but who might not really care about the geopolitics of this war as much.
I mean, I was going to say, Peter, because I feel like you told me about the book well before the war began. I would say at least 6 months before the war, you were starting.
Oh, no, it was a COVID book.
It was a COVID book. I remember sitting with you and you telling me, and then telling me about these the radio and these extraordinary artists, and we bonded over the fact that I'd come across a German Weimar cabaret singer who'd moved here, who was part of the project.
Yeah. The new book is called How to Win an Information War, The Propagandists Who Outwitted Hitler.
And you say propagandist rather than propagandist.
I don't know what I say. I'm quite jet lagged.
Propagandist.
You're right. Sorry. The propagandist who outwitted Hitler. You're quite right.
I'm just setting you up for the rest of your interviews for today.
Yeah, no, thank you. So my new book is about, and it was a COVID project in the sense that because I couldn't travel much in COVID, I decided to do a history book. And I mean, I started it even before COVID, but COVID was really when I had time to get into it. It's sort of a poorly known story, which actually is incredibly well archived by this amazing archivist called Lee Richards, basically about a covert British operation to subvert Nazi propaganda with all these radio stations staffed by members of the Berlin cabaret scene who were sort of pretending to be Nazis, cosplaying Nazis, Jews cosplaying Nazis in order to subvert the Nazis. But it gets really complicated because all the Germans knew it was the British cosplaying Nazis. And the British wanted the Germans to know that they were cosplaying Nazis. It was just a safe way to criticize the Nazis psychologically and physically. So it all gets very wonderfully topsy-turvy. But then the war started. And it took me a long time to finish the book. Thank you very much to my editors and my publishers who did not go completely spare with me. Because I wanted to include what was going on now, and it was just hard to get any work done on anything beyond the war. And so 20% of the book is the war. And I'm trying to understand whether we could use some of the techniques used in World War II to break through the knowledge resistance that a lot of Russians display around war crimes. So there's scenes in the book where I have Ukrainians calling their Russian relatives saying, we are being tortured and murdered. And the Russian relatives saying, oh no, you're making this up. Or if it's happening, you deserve it, or whatever, just denying the reality or denying the responsibility of what's going on. And I sort of relate that to Germany, where a lot of people didn't want to take on the reality of what was happening either. And so there's the connection, really. So
must have been quite hard to weave them back into each other. Did you struggle with it? I mean, like, I'm just thinking there's something about the world of the book living in quite a different place to what we were all viscerally experiencing, and being particularly... Yeah. It must have taken a while for you to feel able to get them both to reflect each other.
Yeah, no, it's tricky. I've done narratives before where I jump from the present to the past. It's always quite hard. But I do think the and maybe it hasn't worked. We'll see. Yeah. We'll see what the reviewers say. It took a lot of effort, a lot of in and out, a lot of chopping and changing in the end. You know, these things almost have to lie organically, as you know. Different scenes just come together in ways that you didn't expect. I was always going to do something about the present, but there was like an idea that I just do right at the beginning of the book and right at the end. In the end, I think it's found an organic shape, but we'll see. I'm sure there will be an X amount of readers who go, oh no, I like the past, but I'm not sure why Peter's put in all the stuff about the present. But most of the people who I talk to say it's nice to see a World War II story made relevant. So it doesn't just feel like a nostalgia stroke. But yeah, no. And also, look, there's lots of ethical issues as well. You know, the Nazi period is seen as uniquely evil for very good historical reasons. So I have to signal that very strong at the start that I'm not making any kind of pat comparisons. There are underlying patterns in the history of propaganda which repeat and are, I think, legitimate to compare, even though, you know, I think there's a reason we don't sort of like, you know, compare the Holocaust to anything else. But the nice thing is I'm not a historian, I'm just a journalist, so
just a hack.
I'm just a person, and yes, I'm making this comparison as a person who studies propaganda. I'm not making some big historical argument about, you know, I am probably ruining a million and one rules of historiography and being ahistorical by even daring to compare two periods. I am, and I think that's what we do, and we take lessons from history all the time, and we probably transform the history as we do that, probably misread the history as we turn it into the present. But because I'm not, you know, at the end of the day, that's my experience as somebody alive today, and I'm not making any claims to grand historical analysis.
We'd like to thank the Open Society Foundations, the Frit Ort Foundation, Goethe Institute in Exile, Goethe Institute for London, and Individual Giving for supporting this little mini-series into the making of The Reckoning. Thank you hugely to our wonderful creatives, to our cast, to our partner, The Reckoning Project, to Marie for co-hosting the episode with me, and especially to Peter Pomerantsev for being here in person and joining the episode. Do buy his book, How to Win an Information War. Or actually, you can catch it in audio form because it is BBC Radio 4's Book of the Week this week. Thank you so much for listening. Rate and review us. Your feedback means the world to us. Thank you so much.